Good afternoon.
No. Really? What?
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome. Thank you for joining us. I'm Alan Davidson, Associate Director of the Center for Democracy and Technology, and our moderator today. And welcome to our last round of panels, our session on anticipating Grokster, a Betamax standard for the digital age. For those of you who are at the congressional staff conversation, this could be Grokster round two from what I saw of it. The conversation continues, and this will be a more in-depth look, I'm sure, at some of the legal issues surrounding the Grokster case. And I was asked to give a short sort of level-setting overview really quickly of what we're here to talk about. So let me start with a couple of questions. When can a company or a person be held liable for the copyright infringement committed by other people? If a company owns a business based on encouraging people to pirate movies and music, should they be held liable for the infringements committed using their products or services? If so, if we do that, how do we make sure that products that people consider legitimate, like iPods or instant messaging or the computer itself, are not swept up somehow in those liability rules simply because they can also be used to infringe? These are the questions that are central to this case. Next month, the U.S. Supreme Court will hear oral arguments in a case of MGM versus Grokster. And an opinion is expected by the end of the court's term, by the end of June. In that case, major motion picture studios and music publishers have sued the creators of peer-to-peer file sharing services, arguing that they should be held liable for the infringing actions of others, the people who use their services. The lower courts have so far ruled in favor of Grokster and Morpheus, and arguing that they cannot be held liable on the grounds that were presented. So central to this case, and central to the debate about it in front of Congress as well, is the 20-year-old precedent in Sony versus Universal. That case dealt with the liability of Sony, the maker of videotape recorders at the time, who was accused of or attempted to be held liable for potential copyright infringements that using its Sony Betamax VCR. In a famous ruling in that court case, now 20 years old, the court held that Sony was not liable for distributing a product that was capable of non-commercial or substantial non-infringing uses. In the words of the court, the sale of copying equipment, like the sale of other articles of commerce, does not constitute contributory infringement if the product is widely used for legitimate, unobjectionable purposes. Indeed, it need merely be capable of substantial non-infringing uses. So in this debate, those are fighting words, right? The question is, what does that mean, and how do we translate that in the digital age? Many have viewed this celebrated Betamax doctrine as a critical protection for the makers of important new technologies that could be used to infringe, the kinds of technologies I was talking about before. But today, we're also confronted with this tremendous rise in piracy, facilitated by the use of file sharing services like Grokster or BitTorrent or Kazaa or the next generation of tools that will take their place. Does that threat then somehow require us to rethink or rewrite our secondary liability rules? This is the question that's squarely, what was squarely before Congress when it tried to grapple with these issues in the Induce Act debate at the end of the last Congress. It's now before the Supreme Court, and to help explain what's at stake and what the court is maybe likely to do and where what Congress ought to be thinking about, we have an all-star panel of legal thinkers and industry representatives. We're going to start with two presentations from two leading legal academics in the field. First, it is, let me just say, a delight to introduce Pam Samuelson, a professor at the University of California, Berkeley Bolthall School of Law. For years, Professor Samuelson has been one of this country's leading scholars on copyright law, particularly in the emerging digital and internet environment. The author of numerous articles on copyright, a former fellow of the MacArthur Foundation, Professor Samuelson is also authoring now an amicus brief in this Grokster case on behalf of a group of law professors. I'm also pleased to introduce Viet Dinh, who's a professor at Georgetown University Law School. He served as Assistant Attorney General for Legal Policy at the Justice Department. He was very involved in thinking about numerous issues surrounding digital communications, particularly the formulation of the Patriot Act after September 11th. A former Supreme Court clerk for Justice O'Connor, a leading constitutional scholar. He has also authored an amicus brief that was filed just a few weeks ago in this case in favor of the plaintiffs in the case on behalf of Kids First and a number of other advocacy groups. So we're delighted to have them here today to set the table for us, to give us an in-depth look at the issues, and then we'll have some responses from our respondents panel. Professor Samuelson.
Thanks for the opportunity to be here. I'm glad to talk with you about this subject. Alan gave a bit of an overview of the MGM versus Grokster case. I want to say a couple more words about it for those people who are not intimately familiar. I think most of the people in the room probably know this case quite well and probably better than I do in some respects. But it is, I think, important to sort of get a little bit more detail about what the Ninth Circuit said, because that's the opinion that will be before the court. There was a summary judgment motion made by the defendants in this case, or by two of the defendants, asking for partial summary judgment on the grounds that the current versions of the file sharing software qualified, they thought, for the Sony Betamax safe harbor. And the district court agreed, and the Ninth Circuit affirmed. The rationale was that there was no contributory infringement because Grokster didn't have knowledge of user infringements at a time that it could do something about it, only found out after the fact. And the Grokster lawyers tried to argue that the same really was true for Sony. Sony knew that some people were infringing, but it couldn't know until after the fact. The court also said that no acts had been done by Grokster and Streamcast other than distributing software that facilitated infringement, and the court said that there was uncontradicted evidence of non-infringing uses and that the software was also capable of substantial non-infringing uses. On the vicarious liability claim, the Ninth Circuit decided that Grokster couldn't exercise any control over its users owing to the decentralized nature of the architecture, and there was, in the Ninth Circuit's view, no point of access for engaging in filtering, and consequently, there was no vicarious liability either. So that's more precisely what the court held. I think there would be very little interest in this case if it was just about Grokster and Streamcast and file sharing software. I think that what's made this case of tremendous interest and of tremendous importance is because of the impact that any change that the court or even Congress might undertake in addressing the peer-to-peer file sharing issue and file sharing technologies is it's going to have an impact on the balance of power between the entertainment industry and the information technology industry about who has what responsibility in respect of protecting copyright. I think it's no exaggeration that the information technology industries, broadly speaking, and consumer electronics too, really regard Sony's safe harbor for technologies capable of substantial non-infringing uses has been a kind of Magna Carta that has actually enabled high-growth IT industries. It's created a stable investment environment for internet and IT industries, and there have been overwhelmingly many substantial technologies and industries that have been able to grow up because of this Sony safe harbor. Entrepreneurs and investors actually can make objective decisions about whether they can go forward with a technology project because of the sort of the clear, predictable nature of the Sony rule. And of course, many of the internet companies are also interested in the outcome of this case because they believe that an open and robust internet is important for economic growth. Sure, there are lots of sort of bad things out there, whether it's spyware, porn, spam, or illicit copies of copyrighted works, but that's got to be weighed against other kinds of benefits for multipurpose technologies. One of the questions that was put to us was, what will the court do, or what might the court do in this case? I haven't finished absolutely every one of the briefs, because they're like gazillion, and it's like takes forever to do. But I think it's... I don't know very many people who think that there's a high likelihood that the court's going to say, gee, the Ninth Circuit got it exactly right, affirm per curiam. I think that that is really, really unlikely to happen. If it affirmed, I think it would be more likely to do so by saying that file sharing of copyrighted music and movies is deplorable, but there is so many... so many stakeholders affected by a change in the rule, and Sony's been a stable rule for a long time, so this is really something which Congress really ought to regulate. I noticed that in the Hatch and Leahy amicus brief, they talk about the to authorize language in Section 106, the exclusive right to do or to authorize as a basis for a secondary liability in the statute. But I think that that's a very thin reed on which to predicate liability in the MGM case. And I think, as you can tell from not only the briefs filed so far, but I think when you see the briefs that are filed on March 1st, which will be the Grokster and Amici briefs, you'll see that there are a very large number of stakeholders, and it's a very complex problem that I think is not readily resolvable through case-by-case adjudication, although we'll wait and see. I would predict that the most likely thing, based on what I've read so far, that the court might do is to reverse and remand, asking the Ninth Circuit and the District Court to do further analysis on the active inducement theory. That's one of the arguments that's made in the MGM brief, and also in the in a number of the amici briefs. There isn't a safe harbor for technologies with substantial non-infringing uses if, in fact, you're actively inducing copyright infringement. There are several other tests that the various briefs are putting forward. In addition to the active inducement theory, MGM has much of its brief is focused on asking the court actually to adopt a primary use standard for secondary liability. That's the very standard that the Ninth Circuit adopted that was rejected by the majority in the Supreme Court, but the MGM brief characterizes Sony actually as a primary use for non-infringing purposes case, and we can talk, I think, as we have a discussion about what problems there might be with a primary use test. Some also were just asking for clarification about secondary liability standards. There are differences of opinion in various briefs about capabilities for substantial non-infringing uses. How do you judge a capability? How realistic does the capability really have to be? Can it be some abstract hypothetical? What does substantial non-infringing use mean anyway? What does substantial mean in connection with that? The knowledge requirement in respect of technology secondary liability, I think, is another issue that the court could try to address. And the Seventh Circuit and the Ninth Circuit actually have a difference of opinion about whether the Sony safe harbor is available for vicarious as well as for contributory infringement. The Solicitor General has put forth a three-part test, which I tried to boil down here. As I understand the brief, the idea is that if commercially significant non-infringing uses are primary and efficient, then there's a safe harbor for the technology, a strict liability standard if there's a high level of infringement and a business model that depends on infringement, and then a multi-factor balancing test in between. There are also some briefs that are arguing for a kind of Amster-like balancing test about how costly it would be to design a technology to reduce or eliminate infringement versus how many infringement losses might that avert. And I think the technology industry is particularly troubled by that standard. There are other standards in the briefs too, but I think to try to wrap up quickly, my recommendation would be that I think it's really time to codify the secondary liability rules, including the Sony Safe Harbor. The IEEE USA actually made a proposal during the Induced Hack hearings that suggested some language that might be adopted. To the extent that Congress chooses not to go after the first, I would recommend that they consider a carefully targeted response to the Grokster phenomenon, much more narrowly targeted. I think that the negotiations that happened this fall over an alternative language for the Induced Act shows that it's not as simple as it might seem to draft language that actually gets the bad apples such as they are and the good apples. And I think Congress just has to recognize that no law is going to be a silver bullet here, and they're really going to have to be a multiplicity of approaches to address this problem. As a law professor, I feel like I also have to say that, you know, if one really believes the proposed findings of H.R. 4077 from last session, that there is this much downloading going on, then maybe it's time to hold some hearings about various of the collective licensing proposals that actually have been adopted, even including by some of the people who are amici in support of MGM in this case. And finally, I'm actually an optimist. I guess one of the advantages of being in the field for more than 20 years is that I've seen kind of one crisis after the other, and we actually have been able to sort of resolve most of the crises before, and I think that Congress and the courts really have a complementary role to play. The Sony Safe Harbor has really been a success. It's simple, predictable, and objective. It promotes high levels of investment and innovation and judicial efficiency, and if Congress needs to deviate from it, it can do so in a targeted way as it has in the past. Thank you.
Thank you for that quick overview and great set of ideas about one perspective on this. And let's, for maybe another view of the cathedral, we'll turn to Professor Dinh.
Thank you, Alan. Thank you, Pam, for that wonderful synopsis of the about 20 years' worth of development in the law, and very cogent and very accurate. I do not have a different view, probably just a different perspective. Before I start that, let me just lay all of my various interests on the table. I have so many interests in this case, many of them not exactly on the same par, so I'm just going to lay it all out there. But we did file a brief in support of the petitioner, or more precisely, in opposition to the Ninth Circuit, on behalf of the National Fraternal Order of Police, the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, and also the Christian Coalition of Morale and Media in support of the studios. And you see the unlikely, somewhat unholy alliances that are just in that one little brief. The Supreme Court requires disclosure of any interest with the party. So that's in a rule called Rule 37.6. And last night I called saw Jonathan. He said, "Your 37.6 footnote is longer than your brief." and I'll just repeat it here. In addition to filing that brief, I'm also a consultant to IAA and MPAA, whose interest is obvious in this case. I'm also a director of the News Corporation, which not only owns the Fox Entertainment Group, which owns obviously the Fox Studio and the Fox Television Network, but also DirecTV and NDS. Which are the content distributors and manufacturers of consumer electronics, DVRs and the like, and so the interest may not be as obvious or closely aligned even within the News Corp family as one may think. Nevertheless, the News Corporation through 20th Century Fox is a petition in the case, and it is an important case, even independent of the realignment or potential alignment of responsibility between the content producers and the consumer electronic and internet community, simply because of the pervasive numbers that Pam had flashed up in the last slide with respect to infringement. What we have here is uncontested evidence that beyond 90% of uses in the Grokster system is for copyright infringement, and that Grokster derives its revenue stream from the advertising revenue coming from such infringing uses. And so at least to one half of the case for the content producers, it is a very significant problem. It is, fair to say, a threat to their traditional business model of investing in copyrighted works and then distributing them for fee over the traditional or non-traditional distribution methods. And the second part is actually quite important. I think that the movie industry and the content industry would be nowhere where it is today without the home entertainment market that the development of the videotape recorder has enabled. And so I think that the content producing community has realized that technology itself is not bad to the business model, but rather properly regulated and properly harnessed, technology is an incredible boon to the overall business model of providing an investing in content for distribution for pay. The whole entire home entertainment market, including DVD now, revolutionized the way films are produced and financed, and allows for much more massive filmmaking of a scale that is unimaginable. But if box office receipts are only the revenue stream, digital transmission and distribution, I think promises to be such a similar boon in terms of low cost distribution for the content producing community. The big question there, therefore, is what rules are to be in place in order to, as Pam puts it, strike the balance between proper legal distribution and also protection of copyrighted works. I think Sony Betamax is a very good rule. Nobody, at least nobody that I know of, is arguing for the amendment to or overruling of Sony Betamax. I think the case there, even though it was a very close case, one of the fun things I had the pleasure of doing in writing the brief was going back to Justice Blackmun's papers on the deliberations on the Sony Betamax case. This was Justice O'Connor, my justice, one of the first years on the court, and she was the one who provided the fifth vote, and she flipped on the fair use question, and so, you know, there by the grace of God, go the entire both sides of the industry. The whole big question there was whether time shifting was fair use, and that was what divided the dissenter and the ultimate majority. The court did not, because it said that time shifting was fair use, and time shifting was the predominant use of the VTR. Did not really focus on what the fighting words that Alan put in this case. That is, what is commercially significant, substantial, non-infringing uses, and also what is a business that is substantially unrelated to infringing uses. The key issues that are in the case here. I think Sony Betamax was properly interpreted in the Napster decision of the Ninth Circuit 2 years back, which authorized an injunction against Napster for its facilitation of pervasive non-infringing uses on its network. After Napster, you had two ways to go. You can go the way of Napster, which is basically amend your business model, re-engineer your strategy in order to focus on legal non-infringing uses, or you can go the way of Grokster, which amended its technology from a centralized service system into a node system, so as to disclaim control and knowledge, and also to disable the login feature in order to decentralize and again to further declaim control and responsibility. The surprise, you don't blame Grokster for it. They're just trying to devise a business plan that is quote unquote the next Napster. What is surprising is that the Ninth Circuit actually blessed what seems to be a fairly clear, if not in intent, then at least in fact, attempt to evade the ruling of Napster interpreting the Sony Betamax standard. And so I think that Pam is quite right in suggesting that the Supreme Court would most likely not affirm the Ninth Circuit in all respects. As a matter of fact, if the Supreme Court does that in this case, it will probably be the first time in 15 years that it has done so on any decision of the Ninth Circuit. I would actually suggest that if the Ninth Circuit opinion gets one vote, I would be quite surprised. So the question then is what standard in order to is the proper interpretation of the Sony Betamax and to guide this case. Everybody, I think, agrees. At least everybody within the province outside of the litigation agrees that Grokster, if they did what the petitioner's evidence suggested they did, it's pretty much out of bounds. I mean, everybody, you know, there are contested issues of facts and stuff like that. The case was decided on summary judgment, and the Ninth Circuit says that under no set of facts would they be held liable, which is why the Ninth Circuit is probably all likely going to be reversed. But I think everybody agrees that if Grokster did what the petitioner suggested that they did, deliberate marketing, over 90% of uses, deliberate evasive structures of technology, legal contract, and business model in order to evade the NASA decision. Pretty much everybody agrees that that's the bad apple. The question then is how to draw that line between Grokster and, for example, the iPod. I think I think that line is actually not very fine at all, because the iPod is more like the VTR, a consumer electronics model, rather than a continuing relationship model that is one of a Grokster type, where you not only have revenue derived from that continuing relationship, that is the advertising based upon the Grokster the website, but also a continuing relationship of product updates and the like that is so frequent it doesn't make any one product a fixed product, but a continually evolving product controlled by the developer. And rather than a person who takes home a VTR or an iPod, to whom the manufacturer and Best Buy no longer has any contact, except with the circumstance whereby they may happen to log on to iTunes in order to get their music. And so I think once you recognize that, and you employ the traditional analysis as to how best to effectuate effective enforcement of the law both civilly and criminally, you also have to agree that the brief of some of the content providers that argues for basically a strict liability test for any copyright infringement facilitation goes a little bit too far the other way. And I think where you end up is about where the Solicitor General ends up. After having mediate amongst all the various conflicting views of the administration, the Department of Commerce and the National Economic Council, advocating the views of the internet and technology industries, the Copyright Office is advocating the interests of the copyright community, coming up with a requirement that basically, if you have a business model that is predominantly or overwhelmingly based upon infringing uses, then you have and you derive revenues from such infringement, basically the Grokster model, then that suffices to give contributory liability. If you do not have that, then there are other factors that you should consider, including marketing, deliberate evasion, and the like, all of which are evidence of your attempt to quote unquote induce copyright infringement. One element here in the Solicitor General's brief that I did not pick up in any other briefs that I think is very critical to remember is that Sony Betamax is only one subset of overall contributory liability, which is generally if you induce or actively encourage the infringement. Sony Betamax deals with the subset whereby liability is said to attach only through the sale, solely through the sale of the product, rather than any other activity of inducement or encouragement or facilitation. And so even if you have this substantial, commercially significant, non-infringing uses defense to that Sony Betamax secondary liability, that doesn't mean that the rest of the whole the area of contributory liability through active inducement or active encouragement or active facilitation would not attach. And so that may be one area that to watch for, that even if the court may not, even if the respondents prevail on the Sony Beta, on the interpretation of Sony Betamax and the commercially significant non-infringing uses, there are other aspects of liability. I think that the Grokster has purportedly have Richard Ronto to be a Supreme Court counsel, probably one of the best, if not the best, and smartest brief writers in this city, a former O'Connor clerk, my mentor in many ways. I think the most intriguing part for those of us who are Supreme Court watchers is to see how this brilliant mind can come up with an alternative test in order to defend what is clearly, I think, an indefensible position of the Ninth Circuit. So with that, I will just end there. Thank you very much.
Okay, well, thank you very much to both of our main speakers here. And just for those of us who only understand Beltway speak, we've got three excellent respondents to give us their quick reactions, 2 or 3 minutes each. Let me just introduce them very quickly, and I'll let them talk from their seats. And I've asked each of them to also pose a question to our two panelists, so hopefully they'll do that very quickly. First, we have Jim Berger, who is a member of the law firm of Dow, Lonis & Albertson, and has been representing technology companies on IP and communications issues for many years. He was a senior lawyer at Apple Computer and has been deeply involved in many of the debates over the last decade and longer over how to use technology to protect copyright, and he's consulting with several large IT companies on the Grokster case. Next to him, we have Jonathan Potter, who's executive director of the Digital Media Association, which represents some of the leading companies providing online audio and video content on the internet. His members include companies as diverse as AOL, Microsoft, Yahoo, Real Networks, diverse in the sense of potential perspectives in this debate. He's herding a lot of cats and has filed a brief with the Center for Democracy and Technology in this case. And finally, David Green, who joined the MPA, who's with the Motion Picture Association of America, where he is a vice president and counsel for technology and new media. He joined in May 2003, also a former Justice Department official, and he focuses primarily on legal issues related to the internet and other digital distribution media systems, and he is obviously the Motion Picture Association members have a substantial interest in the outcome of this case, and many of them are parties. So I'll let them each go through this, and we're looking for a couple of quick reactions and then a question.
Now, so little time, so much to say. Standard disclaimer, this is just me, not my law firm, my clients. Look, I don't condone unauthorized downloading of copyright files on the internet. But that's not the question today. And we have to look at what's before the court. As Professor Samuelson was saying, the petitioners asked the court only to rule on the then latest version of the software, the March 2002 version, and activities after that point. The district court didn't, quote, reach the questions whether defendant was liable for damages arising from past versions of their software or from other past activities. Professor Din said, if you agree with the petitioners, and that's a very important point, if you agree, because those facts are still alive before the district court, and that's why I kind of like the DEMA brief in large part. And if all of the damning conduct alleged by petitioners, and it is all, the 90% is disputed, I tend to agree with petitioners, but I'm not the trial judge, and that's who's much more important than whatever I think. If it's proven before the district court, I think it may very well result in a finding of contributory infringement. That's the one possibility you didn't mention was cert improvidently granted, dismissed, which is what I would do if I was a Supreme Court judge. Let the district court. There's a lot of good stuff in many of the briefs about inducement as part of contributory liability. You have the Gershwin case. I think that's the way to go, because I don't think those acts aren't really before the Supreme Court. Stripped of those facts, what's before the court is whether a technology alone can be condemned. When the trial court found as a matter of fact that the petitioners didn't dispute, quote, is being used and could be used for substantial non-infringing uses, the answer to that bare question has to be no. And Professor Din asked a very good question, what standard? There's something like 29 briefs and maybe 27 different standards for the court to to talk about. That's very rich. But I think almost any one of those standards, other than the traditional one, for example, in the Dima brief, would upset the delicate balance between copyright and innovation that's so central to the Sony case. And it was interesting, Professor Tin said, that what all the content owners want to do is regulate and harness the technology. I love movies. I love music. I buy a lot of it. I must have about 50 DVDs I've bought so far. But the content industry isn't the only industry in this country. 80% of Dell's sales, and we all think of Dell as, you know, archetypical consumer company, 80% are to business. And Dr. Greenspan has talked at length about how much IT has contributed to the overall economy. So to wrap up, I really think that any of those tests would throttle technology and innovation to the detriment. Think about being an innovator and you have one of these sort of business model tests and how many people use for what? 80,000 different works were found to be violated by the defendants here. That's $12 billion. I don't know any innovator who can write that kind of check. So I think it could be disastrous on innovation. At big companies, engineers would have to be fired, sorry, Skip, and lawyers and crystal ball gazers, though they may be the same thing, hired to try and figure out under these standards whether they should launch a technology. And finally, of course, and was mentioned in the panel next door, we've got Lithuania, Vanuatu, and other places, which, unless I've missed something and the Marines are going someplace else, we don't have jurisdiction. I'm with Pam. I'm an optimist. There's all sorts of business model problems that have happened from the player piano through radio, through television, et cetera, that the content industry's not only weathered, they've come out much stronger, and I'm confident they can do that here.
Do you want to ask your question?
Oh, yes.
Right, yeah.
Here's my question. It's sort of one word, but it's a little more complicated than one word. BitTorrent. BitTorrent is not a business, number one. Number two, if you read everything, listen to everything Bram Cohn, who was a programmer, said, he did it with the purest of motives in mind, to transfer efficiently, taking from the Solicitor General's brief, transfer efficiently large Linux open source files, and also bands that permit their fans to tape, as they call it, jack off their soundboard, and distribute. I've looked at a legal BitTorrent site, got over 1,000 files, most of them over 800 megabits. So how do you deal with BitTorrent? I don't think any of the tests, I think it passes almost any of the tests.
Let's not make that a rhetorical question.
No, sorry about that.
No. BitTorrent, question mark.
I think that this is actually a nice example of why a primary use standard is not actually the right thing, or a proportional standard is not the right thing to do, because if you are like Bram Cohen, you put a program out there that is an efficient peer-to-peer system, and it's widely used for a time for downloading Linux, and then some people decide that it's time to use it to trade files of movies. You've put it out there already, and it's unfair for the liability of the technology developer kind of to come hit you 2 years later when somebody starts misusing it, and misusing it enough that an argument can be made. I also think that primary use tests are just going to be a nightmare of evidence problems, but I think that particular example is a nice illustration about why primary use is just not fair.
Professor Tin?
One thing, you can't dig this case, because if you dig the case, you dismiss it improperly, and granted, you don't get to back to the district court. You get right back to where the circuit court is, which is basically that there's no trial, no finding of facts, and stuff like that. In order to get back to the district court, in order to find the facts, you would have to summarily grant, reverse, and remand, which is a bigger slap in the face on the Ninth Circuit than actually if they just simply take up the case. And so dig is not really a viable option if you think that the evidence, the case turns upon the evidence. I don't know the particularities of the facts and the progression of the BitTorrent technology, but from what I glean here, the analysis is fairly straightforward. The technology developer himself should not be liable if the technology is just put out there and is used for legitimate uses. If people however take that technology, assume it's open source, take that technology and then build a whole business model around the infringing uses, then that person would be liable. You don't hold the technology liable. You hold the bad uses of technology liable. And so in that sense, that's why I think that if I said regulate and harness the technology, then I misspoke and I apologize. And it's not the content industry that does that against other industry. It's basically how do we go about, as courts, as policymakers, as commentators, think about the set of rules and conditions under which technology, which are mixed use by nature, can be used for bad or legal or illegal purposes in order to maximize the legal uses and minimize the illegal uses. And that's why I focus on the use or the business model to which the technology is used, not the technology itself.
Jonathan Potter. Just one thing
on BitTorrent. Motion Picture Association, who's never been accused of being non-litigious, has not brought a lawsuit against the inventor of BitTorrent. We have brought lawsuits against those people who connect up people who are looking for movies and people who have those movies as a BitTorrent seed. Those people have been sued for copyright infringement. So I think we understand the differences as well. We're not going after the technology. We're going after the bad users.
Jim, you look like you're...
Well, the only issue with that is a large premise, I believe, of petitioner's brief and a number of the other briefs is that's just exactly why we have secondary liabilities. We can't go after all these people, so I guess that's sort of off the table.
So you have a chance to answer your own question, so I'll turn to Jonathan Potter and let him...
Sorry, Jonathan.
Let him get a word in here, edgewise.
The senator will yield his time. First question is I think why we filed a brief, and I appreciate some of the fact that CDT signed on to our brief, the fact that Jim thinks our brief was good, and the fact that Pam Samuelson is essentially predicting that the court will adopt our brief, because our brief essentially says active inducement, go after it. We tried to actually give petitioners exactly what we thought they asked the U.S. Senate for last year, which was to go after people for their bad conduct and don't go after the technology. What our brief essentially says is the Sony Betamax test has worked. The Sony Betamax decision refrained from articulating any further than it absolutely had to in order to decide the case 20 years ago, and therefore it should articulate a little bit more and should provide a little bit tighter standard for the lower courts to learn from. I had long conversations with the MPAA and the RIAA before we filed our brief, as we were writing our brief. And what I said to them is, where's the conduct? Where's the bad conduct? Why do we have, you know, thousands of pages of the record sealed so that people like me can't go into the record in the lower court and find the conduct and say to the Supreme Court, look, these are bad people. Nail these people. They are bad, because that's what we would have liked to have done. Unfortunately, the record stinks. I don't know if that's because the litigation was litigated poorly strategically by the plaintiffs. I don't know if they rushed to summary judgment. But it is an incredibly, talk about thin reeds, it is a terrible record. However, there are some good pieces of the record that we pulled out and said, you know, it looks like if they go back to the lower court, they're going to find a lot of really bad conduct. However, bad conduct should not be product design. Bad conduct should not be standard operating procedure, product support, product, you know, sales, product marketing. Bad conduct is done by people who intend to promote infringement, who intend to promote piracy. And in that regard, I think we have a whole lot of agreement. The disagreement that is here has to do with, in some cases, the balancing test. I mean, the Aimster balancing test, which is probably the worst possible outcome for technology companies, for innovation companies, would essentially take a look back and say, gee whiz, but for the fact that this product developer decided to write his code, these three lines of code differently, all this infringement might have been inhibited or stopped, therefore he's liable. And you sort of say, hey, wait a second, you got to be kidding me. This isn't the placement of a gasoline, you know, tank in a Ford Pinto. This is a software program which we put out for non-infringing, good purposes. And because people misused it, we're now liable for it because we could have written the code a little differently. That's the Aimster test in a nutshell, and that's why we go after it in a big way in our brief. We are, V had said nobody's arguing for an overruling of Sony Betamax. I think he's being a little cavalier. He may not be arguing for it. I think anybody who's supporting the Amster test, there are people who literally say in their briefs product liability standards have worked for a long time. Anybody who's going down that road is arguing for a wholesale overthrow of the Sony Betamax test, and it would be, you know, not a very good thing. We actually did consider, as Pam Samuels suggested, whether we should say to the court, there's no reason for any secondary liability. It's not in the law. It is a very thin read in Section 106. We decided that we didn't want to do that because we actually like secondary liability. I mean, our companies promote, you know, they have patents, they have software. We like secondary liability. We're actually really, really, really against infringement because we compete with piracy every single day. My question for these guys, and it was very interesting, I thought, when Viet said, he talked about continuing relationship models. One good thing about the Solicitor General's brief is it stated, seemingly as a matter of fact, that the Betamax test applies to services, not just to products that come in a box. I think the product that comes in a box and doesn't have a continuing relationship is old news, and there's not a single product with any sophistication that comes in a box anymore that does not have connections which provide you the opportunity to download upgrades, to provide content on the fly. So, you know, if that's your test, the continuing relationship model includes a continuing obligation, and all of your standard design upgrades have to therefore go back to the Amster test and rewrite your software in order to inhibit any future conduct, you're going to have really, really bad upgrades that are going to frankly tank the product that you just sold the person. And I'm wondering how you define, if that is the operating principle, how does that work in today's, you know, electronics world?
Who wants to start?
I'll be very very quick about it. I think I again, if I misspoke, I apologize. I do think that the Sony Betamax the test and principle there apply fully to the services world, and therefore there need not be a revision of you. I think it applies, but it applies differently because you have you do not have a take it or leave it choice. The imposing one-time liability in order to induce better design in the future of a one-time product like a VTR or like an iPod or something, the traditional consumer products that comes in a box, whereas if there's continual relationship, you do not have that winner take all or take it or leave it choice, and the law can make a much more refined application of the Sony Betamax test. I actually, one of the regret I have in preparing for this panel is that I did not read the excellent brief that you guys filed. I know I read the summary.
It was really quite good.
I know, and I know Larry Robbins to be a very fine lawyer, and I think that Jonathan Porter, with some exception, is a very good, very, very good strategist. But if it says what I think it says, that if
there ought to be some targeted legislative approach to address these particular kinds of technologies, but the Induce Act that was put forward last summer was not a narrowly crafted bill. It created a kind of negligence standard for liability and did not require overt acts, did not require, as patent law does, specific intent to induce infringement. So I think that if there was further discussion in Congress that something like the IEEE proposal, which both would codify the Sony safe harbor for technologies with substantial non-infringing uses and which you embrace before us, and an active inducement provision, might very well be a good thing to do.
But under current law, Grokster would not be held liable?
I don't know the facts. It's not before us. I don't know.
Professor Din and Jonathan Potter, if you want to go ahead. Professor Potter.
All you, Potter.
I didn't read David's brief, so, you know. I think you're probably right that under our test, under, you know, what we've proposed for a Sony Betamax test, if the facts are as simple as you say, that Mockster, if you will, would skate, and that's a troubling outcome, and I don't disagree with you. I think that we have, in the context of writing an amicus brief and working off what is current law and trying to protect the innovation industries, one has to make decisions along the way, and nobody knows this more than probably Professor Din. about how far you're going to push the court to make wholesale changes or what could be perceived as wholesale changes and what's the right way to do it. Also, you obviously have lots of different companies and interests, and I will tell you that writing this brief or quarterbacking this brief was the most challenging activity I've had in the 6 years since DEMA was founded. But there are, and as we discussed back at those on those long summer days or fall days or whatever those were, there are business model tests that are absolutely worth considering. The scariest part for me, and not speaking for my companies at all, on a business model test is actually the small companies. The big company can, you know, if you will, you know, we represent Microsoft and AOL and Yahoo. And, you know, if those companies get a cease and desist based on their business model being founded on infringement, yeah, it will immediately go to the shredder, and the form response will be issued by the junior most litigator in-house. If a small company gets that cease and desist from for example, one of your companies or a content association, you know, I fear that it will actually send chills down their spines. And we all know that enormous amounts of innovation really happen at small companies, which frequently then get adopted by bigger companies or acquired or the technology gets licensed. And that's my concern, is the granularity of the business that's considered, which that issue, whether it's the new operating division or the new software, the new micro division of the big company, if it's on the, what's the basis of the new micro division's business. But more importantly, I think for the smaller companies, it's a concern.
But having said that, I just want to make sure that it's worth considering.
It's absolutely worth considering, depending on where the court comes. I hope the court threads the needle.
Jim Berger, and then I want to make sure we have
to respond to your question, David. It reminds me when I was in the infantry, and we'd be given a mock problem, and you'd be totally cornered and surrounded. You'd say, well, we're going to bring the battleship Missouri up the river. It isn't what's in front of us. But if you, hypothetically, this company does nothing but, you know, supply advertising, supply the software, nothing else. In fact, they even say don't use it for infringing purposes. Yeah, they'll probably skate. And the Supreme Court isn't the right place to make this decision. That's what concerns you, that all these 27 tests. Usually cases percolate up to the Supreme Court with a lot of lower court decisions, a lot of standards being tested, and there's a split in the circuit, which I missed in the briefs. But there's a split in the circuit, and the Supreme Court really looks at what are the effects of these things. The Supreme Court isn't the right place to create a business model test. I agree with you that that company shouldn't skate, but I don't think the Supreme Court is the right body to do that. If we're faced with that problem, hopefully you guys will get these people in the district court, get Grokster and Streamcast, and we get faced with a mockster. I just don't think the court's the right place. We'd have to look at the – because remember, you're dealing with these very narrow facts in this case, and you would in a mockster. We don't have them before us.
I want to make sure we have time for at least a few questions from the audience. We have maybe five more minutes. Why don't we start over here, and maybe you can introduce yourself, Bob Schwartz.
Bob Schwartz, I'm counsel for the Home Reporting Rights Coalition. I'm still looking for the right line that an active inducement test offers, and not just on obscure facts. I mean, first, most – use of audiovisual content is on an authorized basis, however acquired. It's the question of recording that may be, in fact, be facilitated, but is not necessarily authorized. So if we stop thinking about peer-to-peer for a moment and apply these tests the way still most people encounter the content, then first, they're authorized to view it or render it. It's not there back and forth. Second, the Recording Industry Association this week told the Federal Communications Commission if you acquire a song on an authorized basis but you keep it, that's not fair use and it's not protected by the Sony rule. Now, just a few years ago, MGM, Fox, Universal sued Replay, a competitor of Devo, and a specific count was not the stuff that was sent show feature that commercial stealing. It was that continuing relationship that Professor Din said it's not a factor today. I mean, it's an old, VCR didn't have continuing relationships. Well, there's an electronic program guide, they're searching, there's indexing, they're storing and making playlists. And MGM, Fox, Universal said that's inducement. That's infringement. So if the recording industry is right that if an individual keeps one song that that's infringement, then having an electronic program guide, if MGM is right, is active inducement. So I asked the professor which side of the bright line that falls on, and then asked David, is that the view of the MPAA?
Let me say this very, very clearly. The first part of your question has little to do with the question in this case regarding contributory liability. It has to do with the parameters of fair use. It's fair play because that's a big part of the Sony Betamax, and you can see how it interplays into contributory liability. Because if you think of what the conduct that you're describing as fair use, as the Supreme Court did in time shifting, then the whole question of contributory liability becomes a really secondary issue because the overwhelming use of it is fair use and therefore legal. That's why the murky question. That's why the answers for your second question is not so readily available, because the Supreme Court did not have the opportunity to elucidate what it meant as commercially significant non-infringing uses and what it meant as substantially activities substantially unrelated to infringing uses. Those are classic legal tests. And I tend to differ a little bit about the characterization of the 29 briefs as articulating 27 different tests. Everybody is trying to understand what exactly is commercially significant and what exactly is substantially unrelated. Those are the four words that have momentous meanings, and they're not different tests. They're just simply application in specific context. And because those words like reasonableness and the like do not admit of bright lines, you will not get a bright line answer to your question. Finally, with respect to the difference between replay and the VCR, I do want to correct the my position there. I do think that where you do have a continuing relationship, that it imposes a different set of obligation because of the your opportunity to play by the rules are much greater.
Let me actually take the bright line test from a perspective of the technology industry. What we've been talking about for the last several weeks or the last several months is that if you interpret the Betamax standard as if your product is technologically capable of a substantial non-infringing use, then you're scot-free. That's a bright line test. If you want to measure if you want to call a product either black or white, you can have a bright line test. Once you get into measuring conduct, then the bright line tests probably go out the window, at least in large part. We want them to be as clear as possible. We want people to deal with it. We want people to understand it. But unfortunately, we are now in a world of balancing tests. And whether it's the balancing test for fair use or the balancing test for whether you're negligent, you're guilty of second-degree negligent homicide or first-degree reckless, manslaughter, we're into a world of balancing tests. And I think in this context, if we want to maintain things like fair use, and we want to maintain flexibility and innovation, then we're going to have to live with some risk. And bright line tests aren't the order of the day any longer.
Let me just point out one thing. The test, as Jonathan just articulated, basically is a bright line non-liability test. Because with the existence of public domain works out there, any technology is capable of a non-infringing use.
No, and I would find myself in the rare position of agreeing with Jonathan on this, that In fact, you're never going to find an absolutely bright line test where you're never going to find anybody who's going to sue somebody for something that they don't think is active inducement. We've had active inducement in the law, not only in the patent law, but inducing somebody to commit any crime in Title 18 or Title 21 is a violation of the law. It's under the aiding and abetting statute. You aid, abet, or induce someone to commit a crime. So those are all going to be questions of fact, bright-line tests. I will say to the specific point that you raised that TiVo's been in the market for a number of years, that some of our companies like Fox have their own TiVo-like boxes and Comcast. I don't believe that any of those companies have been sued under the law that now exists for active inducement, where it does seem that a lot of people believe that active inducement is right now part of the copyright law.
I wanted to make sure see if we could have time for
one
last question.
Can I actually say?
Oh, sure. Yes.
I I think the question was actually partly directed to me. I think that one thing that affects my judgment about the active inducement proposals and rules of patent law is that if you look at the pre-52 litigation history, what you see was that there were too many people charging too many other people with active with inducement, and the contributory liability active inducement sort of standards were like all mixed up and crazy and confusing. There was too much uncertainty in the law. So the whole point of having a high level of requirement for an active inducement statute came out of the morass that had existed pre-52. So I would hope that that if Congress did take up the inducement issue again, that there would be opportunities to clarify what kinds of things really should be considered inducement and not, in order to create more of a bright line on that side. But I do think that the higher standards for proof, both on intent and sort of overt acts, out of the patent law, at least should be, if the court carries it over, that they should carry over those higher standards, too.
I've been nodding very encouragingly to this question over here. So this will be our last question, real quick.
So and the inducement question, not being an attorney, and glad for that today. Also, since I'm in day, well, I have to explain that my questions have nothing to do with my colleagues behind me. I'm a little confused as to where you would come down on the inducement concept, which seems to be totally broken, and I'm going to guess wouldn't have been part of the law in 76 had the ability to be profoundly impactful internet, in other words, distribution, as opposed to distribution in an analog world. Inducement might not have been part of that principle, but let me just ask this question. Is inducement simply the capability to do something, or is it the behavior of encouragement? And it seems you guys are coming down in different places on that particular question. It seems to me that once the behavior is in the culture, which it is, anything which is digital or recording capable, it could be capable of inducement, because the behavior exists and people will find the behavior.
I won't give an answer. I'll just lay out the schematic so that I'll be agnostic about this for the first time. Active inducement, we all understand, right? If I tell you, go copyright this whole entire book for me, and you go do it, I should be liable for your copying of the entire book. That's active inducement. Okay? Sony Betamax is one subset of the inducement and contributory liability, which asks the question: if you only sell a product that is used for a lot of infringing uses, can you also be held liable? Apart from here's my product, go and use it to go forth and propagate the infringing the works, right? If you by the mere sale, can you be held liable? The Sony Betamax test that we're all talking about is actually a defense to that theory of liability, which says that if you are not liable if your product is capable of commercially significant non-infringing uses, and your business is substantially unrelated to unrelated to infringing uses.
Does that make it clear?
If you advertise it for sort of say, here's this thing, use it to infringe. You provide instructions and tutorials, for example, as an Aimster. That's more. But I think that actually in the patent law, if you sell a product and the purchasers infringe, and you just advertise the product.
That's not enough. Unfortunately, I should have been clear. That's obvious, I think, too. But it's more the BitTorrent world, where if you know what's going on with BitTorrent, you may be
actually, it may be righteous, you know, theft as opposed to, you know, flagrant theft. And by that I mean in the open source community, there is a sort of an attitude which is sort of a righteous approach to, you know, theft. So,
let me just make one point really clear. If you want to practice civil disobedience in copyright, like people practice civil disobedience in the civil rights marches, they were prepared to take the consequences and change the law. And they did it, and they did it well, and they did it effectively, and they taught everybody a lesson. If what the BitTorrent community or the civil disobedient folks in the copyright community are telling us is that copyright has no value and we should eliminate the Copyright Act, and they're willing to go to jail in order to see the Copyright Act eliminated, number one, I don't think they have that kind of cojones, and number two, it ain't going to happen.
You know, I'm not trying to defend the open source community by a long shot, but many of the licenses allow you to freely copy and transfer the programs, the source code for the programs, and that's legal. That's not. But I'd love to hear David on it.
No, I'm going
to
answer David, the question. David, you want the last word here?
I would point out another area of agreement is that we, in our brief, we also encourage the court to go back in Grokster and that they could have found and should have found inducement under that conduct. But I would go back to say, I mean, it's going to be there's going to be gray cases where it's not clear whether it's inducement or not. I mean, like there is in other areas of the law. Grokster is not one of them.
Okay, on that note, first of all, a quick program note, which is everybody is highly encouraged to join the Tech Fair, an event this evening over in the Dirksen Senate Office Building, and it's always a very good event, and I hope you all will make it. Please join me in thanking our excellent panel this evening. Stephanie.